Hello, friends, and welcome. We are here today to discuss Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. It's going to be an interesting conversation for sure. I think if there's some mixed opinions, which is good. And we'll go ahead and get started. Chris, will you start us off?
Yes, my name's Chris Mullen. I'm sometimes YouTuber on the channel Chronicle Chris. And I hang out in the Patreon forums and also do a sci-fi podcast called Speculative Speculations with some other people.
You might have I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And Varsha.
Hi, I've also heard of the Speculative Speculations podcast because I'm one of the people on it. You don't remember, Chris? Anyway, I'm excited to talk about this book. I'm still trying to wrestle with my overall impressions and feelings about the book, so this is going to be interesting.
And Carl.
Yeah, I'm Carl I'm Carl D'Albert. And excited to be here and to wage war on the non-believers, the infidels.
This is a tough one because where do you start? I think one of the questions I have is why no punctuation? Why no quotation marks? What's the choice? Why? Like I don't really have a problem with it, but I'm wondering, why was that choice made?
So we were talking before we came on, you read The Road. Mm-hmm. Is The Road written differently?
No.
Like it's
pretty similar.
Okay, it is. So it's the no quotation marks, no. Yeah, okay. I mean, I don't know. I haven't actually looked that up. I have no idea. I can't tell you. I don't understand it. I do find that, so before this I read All the Pretty Horses. It's the only other McCarthy I read. And I did find that I just killed a bug. That's me. I'm like the kid, just cold hearted. I find that actually there's like a strange rhythm to it that like you kind of like you get lulled into it over time. And like, so that I remember when I started All the Pretty Horses, I was like, when are people speaking? Like, what's going on? And then like, as I went along, I was like, oh, I could easily differentiate in Blood Meridian similarly. Although certainly he even wrote in a more opaque style here that I think is, you know, you were talking to Steve before we came on that like The Road was much easier to read. Right. So I don't know. He definitely is not making things easy on us.
I think if we're comparing The Road to this, I think the difference for me, just surface level, is that there's very little emotion in the characters. I think The Road is full of emotion. It's full of, you can connect. And I think it's hard to connect to anyone in this one.
Yeah, the no quotation marks is usually classic stream of consciousness. That's the reason it's usually done like that. But I actually don't think that's the case here. And I think we'd both seen the same video. And I'd seen it in The Road as well. It's written in almost like a biblical style, you know, in a book of Genesis kind of form is the way it's written. And certainly the start of the book is very like the start of the world, book of Genesis stuff. That first sort of paragraph is definitely in that sense and style. But I sort of like glossed over it by a bit. I think maybe because it's the second book that I've read now of McCarthy's in short succession, I'm sort of in the mood for that. The difficulty in the reading was not in the lack of punctuation. It's the language and the use of the language can sometimes be very hard to break into. Even though I knew sort of what he was describing, sometimes I couldn't get the meaning out of the words necessarily that I think is intended, especially in a first read. Almost impossible, I would say, in some cases.
Yeah, I feel... Is that how we wrote every single book? I'm curious now, just on intellectually, why he does that. Like, I don't think... I feel like he probably does it for a reason, but I don't know what it is, and I can't think of any.
But yeah, keep going, please.
Oh, I was going to switch gears just a little bit. I think to your point, Steve, about the characters not being connectable, I don't know. I think the distance might be kind of intentional that there's nobody here that we like. And I hope. And the lack of punctuation and the prose style overall, I think, provides that distance to a great extent, which is very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I can't speak again to McCarthy's prose style in general, like why he doesn't use quotation marks, for example, or has all these run-on sentences. But the way he handles characters in this book is definitely, like, to me, read very clearly intentionally, where, like, particularly when you're talking about the kid, who is our main character, right? The kid who eventually becomes the man. We're never even given his name. Like, that's as obvious a pointer that we're supposed to, like, he's hardly even human, right? Like, everything is so clamped down. He, like, hardly even feels, which is interesting because I actually think that the balance between his, like, callous capability toward violence and his own, like, he expresses empathy too, which is an interesting, that I think is, they're often very subtle acts of empathy, you know, or mercy, really. Particularly with the Native Americans they encounter in the novel. But I definitely think the distance is intentional. It certainly makes it hard to, like, care about the characters. I don't think I really cared about the kid until probably towards the end of the novel, where, like, something switched in my brain. And I suddenly was like, oh, I get it. Like, these characters, like, certain ones, like Toadvine too, I was like, oh, they actually, like, kind of, there is some emotional connection that with each other, and, you know, they do care, and there's a little bit of heart. And particularly, I think the last chapter, not the epilogue, but, like, the last proper chapter, kind of drove that home for me. Even though, you know, even though we see him willingly choosing to, like, avoid violence, he still, you know, comes back to it, in a sense, with the murder of the boy, who clearly is, like, a parallel of himself. Yeah. So and otherwise, I think I would, you know, go back to what Chris was saying about it being written in a biblical style. It definitely almost felt written, you know, like the Bible, like a myth, you know, where it's like, it's really about these, like, archetypes, I feel like, almost as much as any, or like these ideas, you know, maybe more than these, like, individuals, right? Because the kid, while I do think there is depth to his character, in many ways, he is a kind of flat character, right? Mm. And while I do think also he does change, you know, again, like, he chooses to leave the, you know, the horrific violence. He chooses, you know, to go, I think he goes to, what is it? Is it Los Angeles or San Francisco? Somewhere. And that he, like, but he, like, you know, has his whole life, basically, we see. And the one exception to that, I actually felt like the most developed character in the whole book was the judge. Who to me is the highlight of the whole story, as just, like, one of the best villains I've ever read. And for me, really, like, carried me through the whole thing.
Just before we go on to the judge, the kid is the one character in the book we get a preface to. Everybody else is introduced by their actions. Like, the judge is introduced by his actions with the reverend, except everybody else is with their actions. But we get the preface to the kid's life, insofar as, you know, he's born out of basically blood, insofar as his mum died in childbirth, and we are given the idea he can neither read nor write, and in him broods already a taste for mindless violence, right? So he is shown to us as a character that is already predisposed to having violent tendencies, yet his character and what makes him interesting all the way through it, a bit like you say, he sort of sits in the background. We never really see his acts in the same way as we see other people's acts within the party until the very end, when he becomes part of this morality tug of war that happens towards the end of the book. And so we never really see his mindless violence or his taste for it that comes out. And that idea, you know, the child is the father of the man, the kind of the way that you're born and the way that you're grown up will necessitate what kind of man you're going to be later on, is something that he fights. And I think that's, alongside the character of the judge, that idea is what kind of runs the whole way through the book of, you know, have we got control of our emotions and what the things we're going to do? What is fate? What are we fated to do? All of that kind of stuff. Because there's lots of sections in the book that talk about fate. And then the judge obviously wants to take control of people's fate and stuff like that throughout the book. So I just think the kid is so interesting in terms of being the person that we sort of follow but don't really see in the story.
That's a great point. It's interesting to just, like, a little thing to throw in there too, is that, you know, there's been talk for a long time of adapting this, and there's, you know, kind of I believe John Rogers, I think someone was hired to adapt this recently. There was like news coming out. And I feel like just like fundamentally you're going to see a tonal change. Like I can't imagine adapting the feeling you get reading this book to film or to television, just because through having a face, you know, you're going to see the kid, right? You're going to see this actor. And I think it's also going to be more impactful when, like, I had to continuously remind myself, this kid is like 15, 16 years old. Like, he's literally a kid going out and scalping people, you know? And I do think that opening is so, when you kind of get his origin story in brief, in that very biblical style, it is sort of like Cormac McCarthy, like, inviting you to be like, look at this kid, like, he never really had a chance, you know? And so, but like, but does that mean you should pity him? You know, should you sympathize with him, or can you excuse his actions? You know, because he's just a cog. He's like another one of the, you know, just another one of the scalpers. You know, he's going around, he's doing it. He shows maybe a little more mercy at like very specific moments, but he, you're right. You don't like, we don't focus on his violence, but we know he's doing the same things.
And to that point, I think one of the things the judge says is really interesting about when he's talking about, when he gave the example of the child who whose father died and he has to live up to the father who died, like whatever image he has in his head, it's perfect and he can never live up to that. So he commits atrocities. And then there's the other one who, I forget, is it that he watches his father be cruel and so decides that he needs to be cruel too? The kid is maybe a bit of both. Maybe he has the mother to live up to and the father who, well, I guess that never comes up, the mother. But I thought that was interesting, tying that back to the first scene, that statement about, first, I thought that was a great analogy between civilizations and children and men. But also I like that, how that tied back to the first scene.
Absolutely. I think it is very distinct too, that this is a very masculine book in terms of like all the characters that really matter are male. And you know, the kid, he's lacking that female presence. Right. Immediately he came to the world killing his mother. Now, of course, I think most people, if they hear that, they wouldn't actually think he killed his mother. Yeah. You know, it's like it's the Tyrion Lannister story, right? It's like the fact that childbirth resulted in the mom's death. Like that's a tragedy, but that's not the child's fault. But, you know, it's interesting, too, because there's this ambiguity about like how his father raised him. You know, we definitely get the sense that it wasn't happy. You know, the father wasn't necessarily providing for the kid. He got, you know, he became a drunk. But there is a degree to which, like, we don't know just how toxic the relationship, like, was he actually physically abusive? You know, was he just verbally abusive? You know, what was their relationship? And I think it's in a very intentional choice, kind of circling back to the idea of like the masculinity of it all, that like, I think this is really exploring sort of this like out of balance. You know, if you were to look at it from sort of this like emotional, mythological, like archetypal narrative, because I think it really is like that, you know, it's sort of talking about like the way that this sort of like what we view as like traditionally masculine, like drive to conquer is and to like be physically violent, like is completely out of whack, right? And just is entirely, you know, that there is no balancing factor there, right? And that I feel like it almost comes out of this like lack of, you know, emotional connection as much as anything, because it doesn't seem like the kid had much of an emotional connection with his father, right? And in my mind, my reading of the book is sort of that he's almost like looking for a place to belong, and he's looking for a place to like exist, right? And so he finds this like this family that isn't a family at all, right? They don't care about each other at all, with the exception, I actually kind of feel like, of towards the end, you see that there are little like inklings of connection between like the ex-priest and Toadvine and the kid, right?
Yeah.
Particularly towards the end. And so you see these sort of quiet connections that I think, you know, is really what he's looking for. And it unfortunately seems like he's fated to never find, as we see in kind of the rest of his life story at the end.
Yeah, such good points. Like, the whole book, it's so strange because to me it reads so much like a dystopia in some ways, you know, because it's kind of the dystopia where females don't exist. You know, take females out of the world and what are you left with in this kind of ragtag bit where violence is actually encouraged by the state. You know, violence is actually encouraged as a way of life. Ethnic cleansing is sort of encouraged as a way, as a means to progress society. Like, it is an almost horrific future, you know, hellscape in some ways. And I think that's obviously very intentional, but it also is almost certainly true in a lot of ways as well. So, like, you kind of, I think you're caught reading it kind of going, God, this is awful, this would never happen, while also going, this happened, you know, and that kind of thing where you're trying to dismiss it as fantasy, but also realizing that there is a truth through a lot of it, is a lot of where the play on when the violence, when it happens, how it makes you feel, because it's not just so easy to write off as being, oh, that was rough to read about or something. You also have to sort of live it to a certain extent and own it as part of the reading experience.
Absolutely. I mean, it's based on real history. Yeah. I didn't know that until I was like halfway through the book, but like even the judge is based on a real life person.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's sad. I mean, if you know the Wild West, like the real Wild West was a lot of genocide and violence. And I mean, the whole book is really about violence. Like that's the core of it all. Right. And it's interesting that it doesn't, clearly, I think, you know, it isn't overly, you know, it's not sympathetic to the scalpers, but also then you see that like they're going out and then, you know, some of the tribes, you know, are also just as violent as they are. Right. And, you know, it doesn't like take a side in a sense, except for kind of the victims, I guess you could say, like the ordinary people who get massacred and, you know, pillaged and raped and, you know, just treated terribly by everyone, really. But certainly particularly, you know, our kind of main group of people who are the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
I think that's what I struggled with most in this one is the repetitiveness of it. Because I know that it's supposed to be impactful for these acts of violence, but it seemed like they rode somewhere, they did lots of terrible shit. They rode somewhere, they did even more terrible stuff. And then it's like this cycle that keeps, and I know that was intentional. I know that there's a reason for it, but at some point it's like, okay, I get it. Like, you know, just, it felt a little bit like, and I know that there's other literary references woven into some of the events. I think when they get the gunpowder out of the volcanic ash and they urinated it, that's Paradise Lost reference from what I gather. So I guess there's, you know, I know that there's references layered into it. I'm probably not smart enough to catch it all. So
I think few people are. It reads like an incredibly literary book. There's no doubt about that. Like it has lots of nods and winks and references to things that I just would never have spotted in a million years. But the fact that it sort of seems so intentional is kind of mind blowing. But there are lots of things within the book which are easily identifiable. I mean, the use of religion and God and things and the references are easily recognizable, even in small ways, like when the kid gets captured the first time and he denounces that he ever knew Captain White, for instance, you know, I didn't know him, you know, the very Judas Iscariot kind of way that he dismisses and was in him out and shielding himself and his innocence before he joins up with this ragtag, the Glanton gang, which was, you know, responsible in real life for most of the worst atrocities in that region and in the history of that region. So it works on lots of levels, and I think it's why, like, universally, when you see reviews of this book, a lot of people talk about re-reviewing it. A lot of people talk about having reread it. A lot of people talk about having went back and revisited it later and reappraised it. And I think more so than most other books that I've read, I think the reviews that I went searching for afterwards kind of were more of that than I've read it and this is what I think, than most others.
I do think the one way that things change, Because the book is really, it's all violence. Like, it is what you were saying, Steve. It's like, they go somewhere, they do something terrible, they move on. You know, that's kind of, it's really a quest narrative. That's one of the, I'm talking about references. They reference the Argonauts and, you know, Jason and that classic Greek myth. And you know, I couldn't help but really kind of focus in on that because we're reading the Second Apocalypse, and there's a sort of a similar messed up, dark, you know, inverse Fellowship of the Ring going on, and really kind of hone in on this idea of this like brotherhood of people going on this quest through where the land itself is as dangerous as like the forces, the people, there, you know, whatever that they're going to face. And, you know, obviously in this case, it's disturbing, what they're questing for. But the way I think things change is that they begin supported by the law, and by the end, they're outlaws, right? Hmm. And that there is this kind of like ratcheting up of tension of them just like getting out of control. But you also see it because it's like, well, this is what you wanted. This is the monster that you released. And, you know, U.S. government, like, you can't be that upset when like you tell people, you know, go scalp a bunch of Indians and like, you know, who do you think is going to start doing that? What do you think is going to happen? Right. And so they end up becoming, you know, these just like monstrous tyrants. And eventually the last thing for them to do is to turn on each other. And I mean, spoiler alert, for anyone who's, I hope people are listening, they're okay with spoilers. What happens, and that's how the story ends.
Yep. Just anyone who is curious, we will be spoiling everything. So, I think, and it kind of references that at the end, right? That these men will crave blood for blood's sake. Kind of once they get going, they can't be stopped. Like they almost become addicted to it. It's like it becomes them. They become personification of violence and of murder and horrible acts, just because that's kind of what drives them. So I think that's kind of, Carl, what you're, you know, it's inevitable that they'll turn on each other, because once they run out of someone else, they'll look to each other.
Those that love to dance, as it's referred to much later towards the end of the book. And I love that kind of idea of those people who will dance, and those are those people that love to dance. And that, you know, there's the falsehood in people that will turn up to a dance. And then there's another set of people, and who do you think they are? And that whole conversation, I thought, was just like, when you go back and even reread it, just once you get to the end, because it's only a couple of pages from the end, and you kind of go, there's a lot being said here. You know, there's a lot being kind of brought to the fore here that talks about current life and things that are happening in the world nowadays.
And it's, yeah, I mean, I think it's touching on the idea that like violence perpetuates itself, not just in terms of like the cycle of violence, which I think you see written about a lot, particularly in like revenge stories, of like the idea, you know, there's some horrific murder, and then someone seeks revenge, right? And then they get vengeance, and then that person's loved one seeks, you know, just this like cycle. But also the idea that like the violence itself, like in an individual, starts to like replicate itself in the individual, right? Like it becomes this cycle of like, I just have to keep doing violence. Like it becomes part of you. It warps who you are. And that, you know, if you attract these individuals who are more inclined to that, then naturally, yeah, they're going to start to like kill each other. You know, they're going to start to just like unleash themselves, right? That like violence begets violence. Not just in cycles of revenge, although certainly that, but like even within like the individual soul. And I thought that was interesting because I don't know that I always see it kind of violence explored that way as like something that really does, you know, fundamentally rewrite a person and make them, you know, I mean, that's the kid. That's like the whole thing with the kid. It's kind of that battle. I forget if it's you, Chris, or who, but like the morality play that you really see at the end of like kind of the push and pull of like, you know, do you embrace it? Do you accept it? Or do you actively strive to avoid it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Varsha. We also haven't heard from you in a while.
I had a follow-up question to what you just said. I was curious about the violence warping people, because we don't really get to see any of these characters in their pre-violent stage. All of them are committing horrible acts. So I don't necessarily see the changing. Is it that? So, but there's two parts to it, right? One conversation that stood out to me was the one between some old man and the judge towards the end, when he looks at the ears that the judge has and asks him how he got it. And he wants to know that he killed some people that he hates, and that's how he got them, right? Which is very interesting, because normal people who this ragtag band has been out committing all kinds of horrendous acts, and the US government is probably okay with it, sent them out like you pointed out. But also the people who aren't affected by it, aren't actively in the middle of it all, are looking at it from a distance and are romanticizing it. Maybe they would change when they go into the fray. Maybe they want to get out of it, kind of like the kid did want to get out of it, I think, towards the end. Or maybe they'd be vicious monsters who enjoy what they do. It's unclear. So I guess that's the part for me, if any, that I would talk about saying that violence changed people. But I did want to dig into that a bit more and ask from your perspective, where did you see that happening? Because for me, nobody was good before we met them who was altered by everything they did. Maybe the kid there, but yeah.
I think it all comes back to the kid, exactly. Is that you are kind of told, this is what made him, now watch. And then you see, I mean, the book is interesting, right? Because you are kept at a distance. Like, you're not in his head hearing his thoughts about everything going on. You just see how he acts, right? I mean, this is the most extreme version of show, don't tell. Of, like, you don't know the kid's opinion on things except what you intuit based on his actions. And I partly interpreted, like, you kind of have to, everything you have to intuit. Like, you, so some of it is like applying the kid, what we know of the kid, to the other characters. I do think there's this idea, which I think you were talking about, Varsha, of like some people are just kind of more naturally inclined to violence. I think Chris and Steve, you both maybe mentioned things too, that like, you know, you attract some of the worst people in that regard. But, you know, whether it's the Black Jackson, right, who starts out and seems like relatively, like, pretty okay, moral, you know, intelligent. And then he, by deciding to come with these people, becomes more and more violent himself until, you know, he gets what they all get, basically. And, you know, gets eaten by, you know, it's a snake eating its own tail again. I feel that, like, a lot of the way it really represents itself is also the kind of represents the change is, like, in the escalation that they, you know, when I was talking about violence perpetuating violence, I also really meant, like, the way that it, like, increases, you know, it's one violent act leads to even greater violent acts, right? The way it kind of, like, when it warps someone, it makes them, like, even worse, and it escalates, right? And that the only way to kind of stop it is to, like, fully step away, which is itself, you know, I think you're left to question by the end, like, is it even possible? Can you even fully step away in this world where violence is just, like, baked into it, right? And so, you know, they do get worse. Like, they start out pretty terrible, and they, you know, you watch them become tyrants, scalpers. Like, they don't start out scalping everyone. That's what they, like, gradually become. You know, it starts out, it's like a retaliation against, you know, Native American tribes that the U.S. government is, like, warring with. And it gradually starts involving civilians and, you know, basically everyone, even their own, you know, Mexicans and Americans. It's just, like, everyone they come across, they start, like, abusing, scalping. You know, so I think that's sort of where the change really occurs. But I do think you kind of have to, like, you have to look for it. And, you know, so in some way, I think there's an argument to be made that it, you know, doesn't fully explore the change. You know, it's not like we follow someone who's, like, other than the kid who you can argue is innocent at birth. You don't really see, though, the, like, a full transformation, right? Of like pure-hearted angel into like warmonger.
Yeah, we talked about it last night, Varsha, insofar as this period of American history in Hollywood in the 40s, 50s, 60s is incredibly romanticized in terms of like these heroes that committed those acts, the John Waynes, the people that fought against the Native Americans at that time. And, you know, it's all very shown in a very glitzy, glamorous style. And yet there are a couple of instances within the book, and I think this is where it all sort of, the whole story again centers around the Judge Holden, insofar as he is a character that spends, for all the horrific acts that he personally does, he spends an awful lot of time inciting other people to do acts. He gets in their ear. His very first introduction, when he goes into the church and basically tells the falsehoods about the reverend to the fact that they lynch him, they meet up with him later. He says, "I didn't say that," in classic Judge Holden style. And people don't repent from that. They just kind of laugh it off and went, "Oh, well, such is life." And you see that even towards the bar at the end, when the kid walks into the bar and he sees the judge speaking to the group of people, and then the bear ends up getting murdered as well. Again, that kind of didn't do the act himself, but he just spoke enough things and said enough right things to people to get in their ears. So he incited violence just through words. And I think there's an awful lot of discussion there about, I think what I read from it is that the use of religion and the use of all that kind of stuff can be coercive for both good and bad, depending on the intention of the person that's given or preaching. In the extent, so in the case of Judge Holden, he is saying what seem to be justice-like things, but because of his perception and his view of the world and his love of war and of bloodshed, it's completely warped the message, even though coming from the same words come from somebody else, like the ex-priest. I mean, he keeps on referring to him as Tobin as the ex-priest. He's basically saying he bears false witness here. You know, you can't really believe it. He said he's not even a priest anymore. Listen to me, I'm a judge. And doing those things, I think there's a lot of that kind of morality play that goes on between who you believe and what you believe and how you decide to act on it.
That's a good point. I think the judge for me is humanity, and how easily we can be manipulated and how easily just there's a very thin line holding us back from just complete chaos. And if left to our own devices, is everyone capable of doing these things? You know, how to the what humans are have done and possibly will do in the future or are doing now to each other. I mean, there's not much holding that back. It wouldn't take much to just launch us into this survival mode. And I think towards the end, the whole those who dance, those who don't dance, I think is breaking things down to it's a very simple predators, and there's predators and there's prey when it comes down to it. And that's nature. That's just the cycle. And we're just on that balancing act, just hoping things work out, and we're hoping for the goodness in people and hoping that we can be civilized and be kind to one another. But, you know, if it wouldn't take much for humans to be capable of just absolutely terrible things. It won't take much for that to happen. It's a very, you know, it's an exploration of what humans are capable of, what they've done and what they possibly could do again in the future.
I think what the scariest part about it for me isn't even that it's like survival mode. It's like just looking for an excuse to do this, right? It's like, it's not like you have to do this, right? Like you're starving in the wilderness. And so you wonder, you know, would you eat your best friend who dies, you know, or something like it's like, these are people who are like willfully going out. They can't, like, they have an excuse, you know, they have some reason. Like Chris was saying, you know, often it's like, there's kind of a religious aspect, the whole idea of manifest destiny, right, is fundamentally religious in nature. But it just that we are capable of, like, of war, really, right? And I mean, yeah, you see it all around the world. Like, you don't have to look very far, you know, to see horrible acts of violence committed and just unimaginable. Like, literally, it's like we're inundated with like social media and all the bad shit, you know, that's what gets everyone to click. But like, you really don't have to look far to see, you know, just absolutely, like, it's impossible to process how terrible it is, but like, it's, you know, it's happened throughout human history. And then absolutely, like, you know, I think the book also begs the question of like, well, what is it that keeps us from doing that? Because it's like, this, all this violence was incited by civilization. Mm-hmm. So is it like really civilization? You know, how you would define, you know, right? Like, you have, it's the whole idea of the Westerns too, and kind of a lot of the racist archetypes, right? Is you have the civilized folk and then the savages, right? And often the savage, there's a noble savage aspect too, which is its own can of worms. But like, when the violence itself is incited by the beacon of civilization, right? The government, you know, that there is this incentive to act violently, and not just violently, but like beyond the pale, like scalps, like there's nothing about that. Like, you don't need to, when you kill a person, scalp them. Like, in a financial reason, it's like to prove that you killed someone, right? So you get paid for it, which is its own, you know, you can talk about kind of the financial capitalist aspect of it. But like, basically, I think it gets beyond even any one system, just the idea that like, it's almost like people look for an excuse to like just unleash the worst parts of themselves.
And loop back around to the point again, if you have a system of civilization that's like that, you're only going to incur and encourage the worst people within society who will revel in that. Again, those that love the dance. And so you will elevate those that are the worst in society in a lot of ways by creating a system with that in mind. Especially like, you look at the Glanton gang, they are celebrated when they come into town, and after 3 days they're the most wanted. They can't wait to get them out, and then a week later they're the most wanted people within the whole region. You know how quickly that'll turn around for them.
And to get to it, back to like the idea of like survival in nature and just like what the world itself or the universe is like, you know, because there are a lot of like cosmological kind of questions and philosophies, often very bleak, dark, fucked up ones put forth by like the judge in particular. But, you know, like, how do you even create a civilization that promotes peace and kindness and generosity when the world itself is violent and apathetic, you know, and hungry? And so it almost seems like it's like, you know, the scary, the horror, because this novel I do feel is like kind of a horror novel in many ways. Like, some of the imagery is more horrific than a lot of shit I've read in horror novels. That, you know, it's like, can you even like truly make, you know, something that rewards goodness? Or is it just like kind of the fundamental nature of things because of the survival, the nature of survival, like you have to eat to survive, right? That whatever, you know, systems you create are going to be violent.
Well, throughout human history, when humans have encountered someone else who looked differently or who have a different culture, they're automatically thought of as savages, whether they're more or less civilized, I guess you can say, than we are. Then you look at them and you think, oh, these people are different, and we must eradicate them because they're different than we are. And, you know, even going back to like World War II with Nazi Germany, the people who, normal everyday people, were doing really awful things just because they were told to, and they kind of get, you know, wrapped up in this, in like we were talking about, just this cycle of violence. Yeah.
So I have a question for y'all. Do you, I guess it's two parts. One, do you think the judge is human? Or do you think there's something supernatural going on? And two, do you think there are supernatural elements to the book? Discuss.
The big question of the book for me. I think when Varsha was sending me shit 100 pages to go last night, that was the question that kept me driving to the very end of the book. Is the judge really there? There's lots of, to suggest that he is not. And also, by extension, actually Tobin, in some ways, because at the end of the book, the only people that he sees are the devil and the ex-priest or the god. You know, those are the only two people that he sees around him, and both appear at random, don't seem to be able to be killed, don't, you know, all of those things. But I think the question of whether he's human or not actually is one that I think a lot of people will try and avoid, and they'll say that he's a supernatural element because it's easier to digest if he is you know, supernatural of some sort, or a manifestation of the devil or something like that, being a fallen angel of some sort. I think by the end of it, I was almost certain that he wasn't real because of how he comes and goes and disappears. So him appearing in the jail, him appearing next to him all the time to talk to him at the very opportune times is where I came to on him. But again, that question of if he was human, then the actual tenor and tone of the relationships and the things that happen within the book are even more horrific.
I think the there was a sort of montage at the end, towards the end, where he, where I guess there was a whole paragraph that talked about how the judge was there for the beginning of civilization, was there for the fall of it, and so on. That, I guess one way to interpret that is that Judge is immortal and so was around for all of it. But the other could be that there was a person like the Judge through all of it, making, doing the same things that he was. And that, I think, also echoes what the Judge says about in any dance, there's that one dancer who likes the dance and who thinks that this is the only thing. I'm paraphrasing, sorry, I did not enjoy the book very much as I was going through it, so my attention was flagging, but but towards the end, I think the thing about that one dancer who, I guess, some of the interpretations that I heard from other people helped me through the end of the book. So the dance is war, I saw somewhere, and so the one person who incites the war, the Judge could be that person. And he was throughout in a lot of cases. So, yeah, I think it's unclear. But I like what you said, Chris, about it being a lot scarier if it was not. But on that note, I do have one question. I think there are some things that the Judge says that I agreed with. But most of the times, as I got, what are you on about, man? So I think one example like that was anything that exists without my knowledge exists without my consent. But there were other things that I thought, the thing about civilization, for instance, made sense. So there's, in the interpretation that the Judge is a supernatural inciter of evil, whatever form you want it to take, is the statement here that evil is sometimes reasonable, or that reason is evil? Which is it? And maybe both, depending on the situation, but I was grappling with that because I think I struggle with this in stories sometimes when they want to show something as evil and all it is lost. All it is just something that is more reasonable than others and is making sense. And I think that I find that writers don't do a good job of drawing that line well. And in this case, I think it's unclear, but and it could go both ways. Which do you think it might be?
Interesting question. As far as a Judge, I think, Varsha, I think I agree with you that that's the way I read it too, about there'll always be someone like the Judge, and not this particular person, but there'll always be someone or a group of people kind of continuing the tradition and passing it down through generations. As far as the rest of it, I'll have to think about that for a second.
For my part, I think, well, quickly, I'll try to wrap it all together. I flip-flopped throughout reading the book about like whether the Judge is a human or not. And at the end, I still wasn't quite sure. I think I feel like the themes are more powerful if he is human. So that, like, for my own preference, I kind of feel like it's, you know, as Chris was saying, it's like it's scarier if he is. But you have the moments like where they find him, some of the other guys find him like in the desert, and he's just alone, and he's just waiting for them, it seems like. And it's like that was a moment where I was like, what? Like that was one of the biggest moments that made me like, maybe something's up with this guy. But as for the, you know, the nature of evil and like, can it be reasonable? I think that's part of what makes him so effective to me. On top of like he has the most personality of anyone. Like he's the most colorful character. Ironically, he's pale white, right? which I, sidebar, read this article that's talking about how that must be a literary allusion to Moby Dick and the white whale. And because there's apparently a lot of allusions to Moby Dick throughout this book. I read this whole article about all like the literary allusions. Anyway, you can look it up. There are lots of people who've talked about this. But the judge, you know, I did find him reasonable sometimes. You know, I mean, a lot of the stuff he would say, you'd be like, well, that's a horrible point of view. Like, you should not be thinking like that's you're morally corrupt. I don't like you. Stop existing. But there were times, particularly when, again, like talking about the idea of like, well, when the world itself is so violent, you know, when there is just so much going on around you, like, why shouldn't you then, like, why do you need to feel bad about it? You know, it's like your natural state. Why, like, and even if it isn't your natural state, who's to say it's moral to like not try to enforce your will when the universe is trying to enforce its will upon you, right? And that's kind of his whole thing, right? Is he wants to control everything. He wants to like, you know, to be the keeper of violence and therefore life, right? Life and death. I mean, he clearly has a God complex. And so I do think it's kind of saying, you know, by my reading that like evil can sound reasonable, you know, it can be reasonable. It's just, you know, when you're taking it within the context, I mean, yeah, I think the scary thing about this whole story is like the idea is like, well, why even like, what's the point of morality when everything is so violent, right? Like, you're just another part of it. What does it matter? You know, why not be violent? Because everything's going to be violent to you. And I do think that there is something logical about that idea. Do I agree with it? Do I think that's how people should live? No. But, I think that when you like sit back and think, especially if you, you know, it's a reason a lot of people like believe in a higher power or multiple higher powers that like try to enforce some sort of like universal sense of morality of like right and wrong is that like, well, without that, like, what do you, where does it come from? Like, what, how do you justify peace, right? How do you justify what we would traditionally consider good, you know, mercy, gentleness, compassion, you know, how do you justify those things if there is nothing telling you that you have to do that? And yeah, the judge is sort of this like dark god of being like, you know, justifying violence, being like, no, just do this. Like, it just makes sense. This is just how things are. This is how you are. Just do it. You're good at it. Why wouldn't you do it? And of course, he doesn't really care about these people, right? He happily kills many of them later on. He enjoys it, right? He's the dancer who loves the dance. And it's all about that for him. I was so mad. There were so many times when the kid didn't fucking shoot the judge, I was so mad at the end. That was, anyway, that's a different thing. That's my thought. I rambled. Crisp, you're muted.
That's the kid's morality, though, isn't it? You know, the fact that in cold blood, he would have been murdering the judge. The judge was unarmed. He was sitting there naked, literally, and he couldn't do it. And that thing, he tried to kill him many times afterwards, like he tried to shoot him and all the other stuff. But DeVarce's point, it reminds me a lot of Al Pacino's speech in The Devil's Advocate, if anybody else has ever seen that speech, where he basically talks about how the devil lives among men. And basically, he's there in your ear trying to rationalize the decisions you make on a day-to-day basis. And even within the context of this book, the only guidance we really get about God is that God's always there in your ear talking very, very quietly. And the only time you'll hear or realize you're missing is when it's not there and you're dead, essentially. You'll know that he's not as omnipresent as maybe the devil seems to be on a moment-to-moment basis. And that whole morality play, again, comes back around to the kid and what the kid ends up doing. And the fact that the kid does end up killing the boy is the crux of the book, because unfortunately, I think it ends up being his own demise, because he ends up getting murdered by the judge, I think, because of that one act. But that was literally the point. He had been through all of the horrors and all the morality and fought it all, and then murdered in cold blood, and basically he failed himself at that point, and murdered in cold blood. And
well, what makes it challenging is that it's not in cold blood, because the boy was going to kill him, right? And I think that gets also to the core of the whole story is like, well, what do you do? Is it moral to just like you know, just to like, just take the bullet, right? You know,
well, that's what I was going to say. You know, you even look at murder trials now, murder, but in self-defense, you're free to go. You know what I mean? It's still an act of evil. It's still an act of heinous crime, but becomes justifiable because somebody else justifies it for you. It didn't sit right with the kid necessarily because of what happened, but somebody else says, no, that's okay. And you're supposed to live on the rest of your life with the knowledge that you killed somebody, but your morality will tell you that it wasn't good, if that makes sense, regardless of how somebody else justifies it. And that could be the judge. And that's why the judge is such an interesting character, because a lot of what he does say actually does ring true in terms of day-to-day life and rationalizing decisions you make in a day-to-day life. And God, you know, I worked for that, I put in that claim, or whatever it is that you've done in life. There are always reasons for it. And it's, at what point do you draw the line? And again, the book doesn't really make a judgment call on it. It just kind of presents the characters for who they are and just said, look, this is what happened.
Absolutely. I agree with everything you were saying, by the way. Yeah. Cool. I just wanted to throw that out there. Because
No, you're right in that case.
It adds that extra layer, right? Like, it's like, yeah. That's the depth to which the book is written. It's like, you have to like grapple with, like, you know, I think Steve is the first one to bring it up, of like the idea of like, you know, kind of the survival, and like when, you know, when you're acting on kind of those, like, how do you even judge morality at that level, right? And you know, it kind of asks you to like step outside of, you know, what is reasonable, right? Because I don't know that it is always reasonable to be good, you know, in a very broad sense, right? It's that's not to say that reason itself is evil. You know, that's why, to go back to what you're asking, Varsha, I don't think it's saying that, but it is just saying that evil absolutely can be reasonable.
Yeah. I think interesting as well, I marked a few bits. The kid isn't not under the influence of the joke, because he starts to speak like him in some bits. He was speaking to Tobin about, you know, we'll hide, you can't hide, all that kind of stuff. And there's a couple of bits throughout the book where he mimics a lot of what the judge and the way the judge speaks, which is why at one point I actually thought the boy was the judge. I thought he was seeing himself in later life. Well, obviously it didn't turn out that way, but anyway, I thought again that was a possibility within the book as well, that you could see him morphing into that, or sort of, he was on the journey. And all it took was an act here, a compromise there, and it would have fallen apart. But he definitely was influenced by the people around him, for good and for bad, you know, in some ways. And the people that he ended up being with, in that case, Tobin at the end, versus the judge, kind of speaks to that.
Speaking of things we agree about with the judge, late in the book, there's a quote, "What joins men together," he said, "is not the sharing of bread, but the sharing of enemies." Mm.
Tribalism, yeah, it's a real thing.
He's right, though.
I would argue, personally, I believe tribalism is both. You know, it's like the idea of like sharing resources in general, or perceived resources. They don't have to be real, but the perception that there's a limited amount of something, and you know, even something as esoteric as like social capital or political capital, and therefore you have enemies. You know, however you define them, right? I do believe that that is, yeah. It is. He has a lot of great speeches.
Yeah.
Some of them just, I mean, most of them, actually pretty much all of them were like just atrocious, but like really, I found him so compelling. I loved it. I love that he's like cartoonish too. He like, the word that sticks in my mind is like, he pirouettes a bunch. He pirouettes like a ballerina. Like it's this giant, pale, like, strong but like globulous man who pirouettes
stone or something, isn't he? You know, he's yeah.
And he plays the fiddle, and like he's like super intelligent, and he talks like nobody else talks. You know, he's the only person who talks like he does. And I loved him just as a character, as a villain. I just thought he was just so rich and so interesting and horrible, just horrible. What do you think happened at the end to the kid? How far do you think? I mean, I assume we agree he died, but I don't know. It's left vague, right?
It is. Two schools of thought on it. right? There's one that basically says he was smothered to death, the judge smothered him, which I think is interesting in its own right, because I think there is that indication that the judge seen something in the kid that he wanted to turn and kind of went him like he was the father in some ways, and so he almost killed him with kindness. In some ways, he hugged him. Everybody else in the book, like Glanton, gets an axe to the head. Lots of people get hung publicly. The kid doesn't have that violent death like everybody else seems to have in the book. In the same way, he basically gets smothered to death. But there is a perception a lot of people have that he was sexually assaulted by the judge, and that when they opened the door, that's what they seen. That rather than just the murder, because murder would have been kind of, okay, somebody's dead in the stalls. There was something worse that they seen when they opened up the jakes or the stalls, as it was.
I think that makes sense given a different scene where, is it the kid walks in on the judge where he's naked? By the way, why is he naked all the time? Naked. And there's a girl also naked, and then a third person who I forget. And clearly something has happened or is about to happen.
It's the idiot.
Oh, yeah. The idiot.
So they call him. That's the other person who's in the room.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
For what it's worth, too, that scene with the girl is not the first time that there's an implication the judge rapes children.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't know if this demonetizes things, saying that word. But there's a lot of implication that the judge... Pretty much any time there's a mention of a missing child,
yeah.
I was like, oh, the judge. Like, there's always some other scene that kind of implicates the judge. The last version, I heard a third theory, which okay. I did not agree with. I had a visceral reaction to, but was that the kid, it's not the kid who's found dead. The kid killed and maybe assaulted some, I forget who, what the theory is, if it's like one of the prostitutes or something, okay. I think just my thought is the nature of it being so horrible that the kid had to, or the man as he is then, had to have been sodomized at least or something, that like it wasn't just the certainly the smothering, I think, is probably how he died, because that's kind of the implication, right, of the embrace, yep, at the end, right? But I just feel like there had, or his body was desecrated in some, I don't know.
I mean, there is the other theory, obviously, that the kid became the judge. You know, that kind of cycle, there always has to be somebody in the world. You know, it has to be. So it's actually the old man judge that's actually dead in the stall, which would also be like 24 stone white, would be horrific if you opened up the stalls in that case. And, you know, they could do that. But I do think the kid, because of the nature of killing the boy before it, Elrond or whatever you call him, I think it kind of gives a bit more of a cycle than of his story, if you know what I mean, and gives it a bit of a resolution. Because at that point, he may as well be dead rather than morph into the judge. You know, as far as us as the reader goes, you know, he's dead anyway. It's a powerful end, though.
Definitely is, yeah. The descriptions were the writing, the prose. I think we can all agree that it's very well done, obviously, but the descriptions of the environments were great too. I think it just, the repetitive nature of it was what kind of would start to lose interest, and it would become a little bit too familiar every time, like the same. And I know that was intentional, but.
No, I get that. I mean, it definitely is. It is a lot of the same. I mean, it really is a book about one thing. You know, that's maybe being too simple, but like, I think the core theme is violence, clearly, right? And that, so it's just like constant atrocities. You know, I think I mentioned before we came on briefly to another friend of ours, the Tree of Dead Babies. I completely missed that the first time through. I'd confuse some things. And I remember seeing that like in a, at like the start of the chapter. And I was like, where is this? Mm-hmm. And it's like mentioned in like, it's like two lines. You know, I think they do like describe it a bit more, but like I somehow missed it. Like I just did not get it. And like that is kind of the whole thing, right? Like a horrible act of violence that would define a whole book is like just one of many. It just continues. And it does sort of desensitize you, you know, and just feel repetitive. And, you know, I can understand definitely how that's, you know, not engaging necessarily.
I think I found the repetition very difficult to read, and the overall and how much of it was description of landscapes. But I think it served several purposes for the kind of book that it is. One is, I guess the repetition gets numbing, which I suppose is one of the points, that these men are numb to the violence they're committing. I don't know that I got the sense that they ever had any compunction about the violence they were committing, but they did devolve more and more as they went along. And I guess to a certain extent, we are numbed to what they are doing as well. Maybe you're supposed to grapple with that afterwards and say, okay, why am I almost okay with this at this point? And then there's, of course, like the de-romanticizing of whatever it is that was mythologized, like you were talking about earlier, Chris. I think that too is served by the writing a great deal, in that it moves so slowly, it's plodding, and none of it is fun. So it's taking out all the things that you might potentially enjoy about a book. I don't think this book is ever meant to go with the word enjoy in the same sentence. And I think that, so for all that I did not like reading the book, about halfway through I got very bored, I can see how it works to do what I think the author probably wants to do, which is really brilliant overall.
It's so funny that for me, I was like intrigued by the book. I was enjoying it, but I was reading it like one, maybe two chapters at a time for a long time. And then I got to about halfway and I just like started devouring the book. I distinctly remember a couple of weeks ago, I was like flying out. I was on a flight and I just started just like going through it so fast. I wonder if we had sort of similar turning points, but just in like the opposite direction, you know. I don't even know what it was that fully clicked for me, but I just like, I checked into the characters, and I think maybe it was really getting more time with the judge. Once the judge was like a main driving force, I was like, I was here for it. I just wanted to hear him wax poetic, you know, about his messed up view of the world.
For me, it wasn't until the boy was by himself and we had that sync again, we seen him as a character and we seen his, that was that point that it became very easy to read at that stage. But before that, I think it goes to the point, because we talked about this quite a lot of the books that we've read. Great prose doesn't often make it easier to read, you know. Sometimes really flowery, great prose can be too dense to really dissipate. You can't tell the difference between description, allegory, metaphor. All of those things are kind of layered on top of one another, references to something else, and you're not sure which is why when you see the sentence about a dead baby, sometimes you're the dead baby tree, you're not sure whether it's an allegory or whether it's actually happening, or to that extent.
That was what killed me, was I that horrible choice of words there, but that, like, when I was reading, there's a line that's very explicit about it being a tree of dead babies. I guess I didn't read that line, because when I went back and reread it and saw it, and they describe it in a way that, to me, I was like, oh, this is very clearly metaphorical, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, this is symbol. Like, I couldn't tell that it was talking about dead babies. Yeah. And then I went back and I was like, oh, it's literally talking about dead babies. Yeah. Like, just to get to your point that I agree with exactly. It's like when the prose is that dense, like, you know, it can be easy to get lost.
But if somebody could pull out like 50 paragraphs out of this book and haven't finished the book and haven't had this discussion, those 50 paragraphs would have incredible deep meaning in by themselves the whole way through. Like it is that. But in the context of that flow of describing the things that happen in the chapter and the journey that they're on and that quest nature, as you pointed out earlier, Carl, you know, you don't see it. You can't picture it, you can't feel it. And I dare say, if I read Moby Dick, I would see more. If I read Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad, I'd see more. You know, that kind of stuff. It would all pour out of the book at given points. Beautifully written, though. Beautifully, like, honestly.
I loved a lot of the similes that McCarthy used in, I think, while I was still interested in paying attention, I underlined almost every single one that came across, especially the ones that involved the night sky and the stars and the darkness. I think he did a lot of those in The Road as well. I loved how they were structured, and I loved the comparisons that he made. Yeah, I agree. The writing's immensely beautiful.
I'm curious. So, particularly Stephen Varsha, since you were not as like engaged with the book, did the ending, like particularly like the big climactic, like I hesitate to even call it like an action scene, because there's not, you know, it's a lot of people not shooting each other and hiding. You know, it really is kind of a horror movie scene. Was that as tense? Like, did you feel like that to me was like, I was on the edge of my, I could not stop reading once I started it. And I was curious if that was impactful for you, or you were like emotionally checked out enough that it was just like more words.
Go ahead, Varsha.
I mean, I think for me at that point, any further violence was not likely to have any sort of impact. I think maybe for me, the peak of cruelty was at the thing with the doctor, when the doctor has a bunch of money and these guys agree to fortify the area for them, and then they sink into such violence and debauchery that the doctor starts to feel bad for engaging them, and ultimately the doctor dies. At that point, I was like, there's nothing good that's ever going to happen. So anytime anyone was in a room, I'm like, who's going to die from this? It wasn't shocking, or it wasn't any more interesting than anything else on the rest of the page. Like it wasn't different for me. I do have one question about the ending, but I'll let Steve answer the question first before we get there.
Yeah, as far as the end for me, I think I was kind of just checked out. I think after a while, I couldn't feel a connection to anyone. It was more of just like a fly on the wall, seeing all these things unfold, and we really didn't get in anyone's head or didn't have a connection. Even characters I don't like, because there's no likable characters, you couldn't really get a connection. And I think, like Varsha mentioned, once there's so many different, it's not only who's going to die, is how much are they going to suffer before they die. So by the end, I was just kind of just checked out. But I did go back today and reread the last 50 pages or so, and it was a lot more compelling and more, I won't say fun, more interesting the second time around.
Well, that was part of, fun is such an interesting word to use, but like I felt like I was even more, again, like on the edge of my seat, you know. Again, it had like the horror movie element of like you're running from the monster when they turn on each other. So I'm talking about like when you know, the scalpers are, you know, our fellowship, our fucked up fellowship, all like kind of starts to turn on each other. And then suddenly, you know, it's the kid and like the ex-priest and Toadvine versus like the judge. And I was like checked in. Like that was, I was like, it suddenly almost felt more like dramatic in a sense, and it was less like, I was less like caught up in sort of the very, you know, wrought, you know, melodramatic biblical prose, right? Which I do think there were periods where it carried me through more than just like the actual, what was actually like happening on the page. Because to me, I was like, holy shit, like they're all just like killing each other now, and like, kid, you need to fucking shoot the judge. And then he didn't shoot the judge, and then the judge has two guns, and I'm like, oh god. And I'm as scared of the judge as like all the characters are. And so they're like hiding, and I'm like, don't get found. You know, it's like the monster in a horror movie. And so anyway, there's a reason I was asking. I was just curious, because that to me almost felt like more blockbuster. Like it felt very climactic. Not even talking about like beyond it, when in the last chapter where we get like kind of the rest of the kid's life, when he's the man, right? Anyway, that was just me.
Yeah, I wasn't. I don't think I was sufficiently fearful of the judge to appreciate that at that point. I don't know why. It is interesting. Like, the judge was a character that I was very much looking forward to meeting in this book, based on, because everyone who talks about the book is sure to mention the judge, and they find him to be pretty profound from what I can gather. So I was eager to meet him, and I already tried from the very first time we meet him to read him as the embodiment of the devil in some form. And I see it, but it didn't build to the extent that, like, I think the book as a whole has left a lasting impression on me, perhaps, but the judge separately from it all, not so much, I don't think. So I think there is this conversation towards the end, I forget if it's with the kid, now the man, or someone else, but the judge explains his philosophy, the one in which he talks about the dance and so on. I do see a little bit how it might tie things together, but one, it felt a bit too little too late, but also I was having difficulty trying to understand how that explained the rest of that book, if that makes sense. So I wanted to know what insights all of you had about that, how you thought that last conversation tied back to the rest of the book, what else we were looking at throughout.
So there's a couple of conversations towards the end of the book. There's the one when he's in the jail and the kid's trying to disavow that he was responsible. It was all the judge. And the judge was like, going, no. It was you. You were there. You were responsible by, you know, and the kid won't own it. And again, there's another good point where the judge is actually correct. You know, he hasn't told any lies in that part because the kid was part of the gang the whole way along. And, you know, he can disavow knowledge of it. So there was that part, which I think sort of ties it together again. Are you talking about the one then after that in the bar?
Yeah, the one where he talks about the dance.
Hmm. And about the men who will dance, and who do you think they are? That one.
Yeah.
For me, you can read away there, Carl. For me, because I actually stood over that a little bit. I think at that part, the book starts to be a bit third wall breaking. If you know what I mean, it's very much about right. We've presented the story in the Wild West, so to speak, and I'd say, but actually, what does this mean today? What does this actually relate to modern society? If we're still talking about dance and the fact that war is the dance, the bloodshed, and that thirst is sort of happening, again, the people that are drawn towards it, the people that are signed up because it pays a wage, all of that kind of stuff that are inferred to it, who are the people that are really enjoying that, and who do you think they are, and what role do they play within society? Because I think that a lot of that is McCarthy using it as a soapbox a little bit and kind of saying, look, I think we need to talk about this a little bit. And this was written in 1985. So this was before the Iraq War. This was before a lot of those major conflicts. It was, you know, many, many years after Vietnam, etc. So as an American kind of writing this book, he's sort of caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts. It was just after the Falklands War, etc. So I think it's a really interesting book for then, especially the time it was written. If it had come 10, 15, 20 years later, the allegory might have been even stronger for me.
Hmm. I think it begs the question of, will those people always be there?
Mm-hmm. And will that's always be kind a judge? Of, you mean the ones who incite war, right?
Hmm.
That's kind of the point he makes with the one, at least one man who likes all of it, right? At least I that's how I read that scene. But one quick follow-up question, Chris, the conversation when the kid is in jail, he tells him that you were responsible. But if I remember correctly, I got the impression he was blaming him for all his moments of kindness, not for his acts of violence. He said you shaped everything you did when you... I think that's what happened, which is why I found that conversation jarring and interesting. Like, that adds to the theory that the judge is evil and does not like the acts of kindness. But... I may have misread that too. Like I said, the last half slightly checked out, but that's what I seem to recall from there.
So I think just having quickly kind of read through parts of it and skimmed through the dance conversation in particular, I mean, I think a lot of what the judge is saying is like, this is just kind of history, like history repeats itself. He talks about how like, you know, the players are here, but they don't necessarily, you know, and he talks about like essentially like everything leading to violence and that they may not necessarily, an individual may not necessarily have within him this drive to violence, but like if he's put in these positions, he will commit the violence, right? And that, you know, and he's talking about, you know, the judge is talking about how this is like almost like, you know, it's glorious, it's fun, it's beautiful, it's a dance, right? It is an art. And I think one of the big impactful moments towards the end was, you know, when the kid says that even a dumb animal can dance.
Yeah.
And it's kind of talking about how, you know, the judge is trying to elevate man as this, like, the masters of violence and war, and the kid being like, you know, no, like, that's not what separates us, you know. If anything separates us, you know, even this bear can dance. And it's such a goofy image of the dancing bear, right?
Yeah.
But that's a little thing too. I don't know if you guys found the book funny at all, but there were definitely moments I found very blackly comic.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but there were moments. And yeah, there's just that the idea, you know, I mean, I think you could interpret a lot of different ways, whether or not, you know, humans are not any different than other animals, which I think is an interesting thing to ponder, or that, like, you know, what makes us different isn't a capacity for violence. That's not the point, you know. The dance can be done by anything.
Mm-hmm. There was one scene I reread earlier today that was, I forget who it was. They said, you know, they don't ride at night. And someone said, why don't they ride at night? Because it's dark. Just little yeah. tidbits.
It's a lot of those moments are like really subtle and they happen very quickly. And like, there'll be like a throwaway line or something. And you like go back and you're like, wait, that was actually kind of funny. Like, yeah.
My favorite was when the judge was demonstrating something with a coin and the guy he's talking to says, I'll tell you where you can put that coin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of in the dialogue. Like, yeah, there's just these great, yeah, darkly comic. I enjoyed that. I didn't expect the book to have any sense of humor, so having even just like rare moments of dark comedy, I thought was fun.
I think one of the things that makes this so great for me as a book is the fact that there's those passages, a bit you were talking about, everybody's kind of brought up a couple that were, you can read two or three ways, and even myself, I'm kind of very conflicted as to which one I like the best, but all three make complete sense in a lot of ways for communicating a different facet of a slightly different message, but kind of tying in thematically to the same overall picture. And I think, like, I bounce back and forward as to what, like, what happened to Boy at the end. Doesn't matter if I think this, does that change my perception of the rest of the book or the novel? Does that colour all the things that happen? Does that colour the ending? Does that colour thing? And you kind of settle on, I don't think I've ever, we talked about this actually with a book we read recently, is like, I'm going to pick that ending and then I'm going to be happy with it. Blood Meridian is a book where I'm kind of like, it's all of those things. It's sort of all of them at the same time, which I think, you know, but if you're a novelist and you manage to pull that kind of stuff off, you're not doing too bad.
So I did have a question. I'm going to try and make this a not too ranty question, but okay, so this book is celebrated, and I'm surprised it's so celebrated because of the content.
Yeah.
And not that I have a problem with that. I'm just comparing that, and I'll try not to make too many comparisons to Second Apocalypse. But I'm curious as to why everyone thinks that this book that is wall-to-wall violence, pretty terrible violence, is celebrated when other books that are particularly in fantasy, I think you could make the case for horror too in some cases, but mostly fantasy, these fantasy either books or series that have similar violence sprinkled in. It is not wall to wall, but it's similar violence, but have that dive into the same themes and ideas and explorations are viewed from as some as like edgelord stuff or, oh, that's for edgy teenagers. And there are some shock value books out there. I've read them. They're not good. And I'm talking about the ones who have actually the books that actually have substance that are trying to explore these themes and ideas. Why are those being seen, do you think, differently by the general reading audience, like readers in general? Is it the writing style?
Well, maybe a little bit. You know, I do think the audience, because you don't know who's, you know, how it's, what individual reader you're going to get, right? I do think that people who read, you know, so-called literary fiction, which this novel, you know, arguably is, are maybe a little more accepting of things. But I think the big thing is just like sexual violence and the conversation around, there's not any explicit sexual violence on the page. There's a lot implied, but there's not a rape scene, you could say, right? Where you see particularly a woman, you know, be assaulted in that regard. And I think that is a lot, like I think that's the biggest part of it. It's just that like a lot of the darkest stuff that I think of have like explicit sexual violence. And that's often what they get kind of attacked for. And that's not to say that I think that's necessarily fair. You know, I think there are times where like, I think it's fair to criticize, but like, you know, we were reading the Prince of Nothing, the Second Apocalypse in general. And I think a lot of the violence in that series is very intentional, but like, it's also a lot of the violence is much more explicitly sexual in nature, which I think versus this, where it's like dead babies in trees and scalps and, you know, and there is the sexual aspect, but it's understated, right? A lot of it's implied as opposed to being on the page.
I think part of it also comes from the fact that it's viewed in the context of his entire work, Cormac McCarthy. The fact that he wrote a lot of singular novels, like some of them are thematically linked, etc., but they're all standalones, and that Blood Meridian wasn't celebrated in 1985, but by the time Cormac McCarthy wins a Pulitzer in 2007 for a sort of similar novel insofar as it's kind of like very bleak and all the rest of it in The Road, you kind of view his earlier work or his other work through different glasses. You know, you see the different lens of it, and people will be much more prepared, especially in literary circles, to say, actually, this is real merit and value because of the themes that it very strongly resonates. Actually, once you see past the violence, you'll see more in that. And I think that's true for many things, whether that's movies, TV series, all the rest of them. Like, you know, time can be very good in looking back and saying, actually, this was a masterpiece in ways that we couldn't see at the time, or in ways that we couldn't see at the time. And especially, like, I get the novel that it reminds me most of actually is Beloved by Toni Morrison, which again is very dark and about pain, written very beautifully, very hard to read sometimes. But again, she won the Pulitzer for that as well. And again, the more that those novels kind of pervade into the masses and pervade into the consciousness of literary circles, the more that people will seek out things like that, and especially for somebody that it became as celebrated as Cormac McCarthy.
I think there's also the fact that literary fiction readers tend to not consider fantasy or speculative fiction serious fiction. So I think there's a barrier to entry there already, just people who will refuse to read it just because they think any fantasy or sci-fi is for children.
Yeah.
So that already significantly reduces readership and acceptance.
And I think on a similar level, a lot of the fantasy readership goes to it wanting a specific type of story, you know, in kind of a similar way that literary fiction readers may prejudge fantasy. Fantasy mm-hmm. readers prejudge fantasy. And so when you're presented something that they didn't necessarily go into wanting or expecting, you know, like if they want things to remain tonally around Lord of the Rings or Aragon or, you know, insert any number of things here, which is not in any way an indictment of those things. Like, you know, I love Lord of the Rings, but just that in terms of like how dark you're willing to go and what you're willing to grapple with, I think it absolutely can put people off. And I think it's really expectations as much as anything. I mean, I think both Chris and Barsha, you were saying, I think, very insightful things there. And, you know, Chris, I think that's a great point too, just again, highlighting the idea of like, you know, when you look back on things, sometimes people, or with added context of like a whole body of work or things like that, that people are maybe more forgiving of things that they may be more quick to judge just because of how it makes them feel initially.
And actually to add to that point, very good point, Carl, is the fact that this is a book that has prompted rereading over the years. People didn't don't like it on first readings a lot of the time. It is something that gets poured over again and again, and that takes time. Like nobody's putting down Blood Meridian going, I want to reread that immediately. I need more of that world. That's going to be fantastic. Get me back in that world. I don't want to not be there. But it is the kind of thing that will pervade in your memory and pervade in your thoughts for a long time and think about, especially like Judge Holden as a character and the question that he's now become probably famous for being maybe the most evil character in all of literature.
So we know Carl has to run, so we'll wrap up. But just as we wrap up, that's why I love these discussions. I have a different kind of different viewpoint on the book now. So Carl, you win. Congratulations.
But, yes.
I didn't love it, but I definitely have a different appreciation for it. It'll be one that I'll read in bits and pieces at some point just to kind of slowly digest, because I think it's a lot to read even in a few weeks, because it's a lot. But with that being said, Chris, can you start us off with the outro and just tell us your general thoughts about the book?
General thoughts on the book is one that I would say my reading experience was very sort of up and down through it. I think we talked about the fact that towards the end I really took ownership of where the story was going and the themes that it was presenting. But for periods before that, it was like, I can only do a couple of chapters at a time here because it's dense. It's kind of, I don't know if I'm enjoying it so much. I'm experiencing it. So, but like you just said, these conversations are amazing for drawing out multiple thoughts and kind of putting them all together. And my experience has now morphed and changed even after one reading. But my name's Chris Mullen, Chronicle of Chris YouTube channel, PageTune Forums. That's it.
And Varsha.
Yeah, I think I really appreciated this discussion as well. Like I said, I about a halfway through, I was checked out. I wasn't liking what I was reading. And I looked up a few Goodreads reviews, 5-star reviews, to try and motivate myself to see like what helped me make sense of this. And I didn't like what I read there either. Like, I think one particular review I followed was talking about how it talks about man's capacity for violence and depravity. And the overwhelming question I had was, what about it? I guess some of the discussion we had here helped. So yeah, thank you. I do have a fresh perspective on it. I don't think I'm going to reread it anytime soon, but maybe sometime. We'll see. Yeah, you can find me on the YouTube channel Reading by the Rainy Mountain and on the podcast Speculative Speculations, among a few other places. And I hang out on the Patreon forum all the time.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it definitely was a profound experience. I guess. I don't know. It's something that I found very impactful and interesting. And I'm certainly not going to reread it anytime soon. I want to read a lot of the works that it has allusions to, including Moby Dick, which I have not read yet. But, you know, I also, that's not to say I didn't have criticisms. I definitely did. You know, I couldn't say that I found a lot of the characters, you know, overly memorable. That said, I actually remember a surprising amount of their names, which is something considering a lot of them don't even have names. But for me, the judge was really the standout. And, you know, I didn't give a shit about the kid, to be honest, for the longest time. But I think the end kind of brought it back around for me. And so I think I'll be a little more aware, I think, on a reread of kind of his story. Because you are kept at a distance, you know. And it's an understandable tactic, but it does come with the flaw of, like, why do I care about this person, you know? But anyway, you can find me on social media, a lot of places at Carl D. Albert. Find me on the Page Shooting Forum. I'll be around. And welcome, Jared, for the jump scare at the end.
And for anyone who enjoys tragedy and grief, Carl didn't plug his book, so I'll do it for him. Go read Truth of Crowns. I will leave the links below. Be sure and check it out, and you'll enjoy it. So until next time, visit us on our forum. I think we're discussing what book we'll do next, but we'll be figuring it out soon. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and hope you had fun. And I don't know how to close out a book like this, but anyway, everyone have a good one. Thanks for listening.